Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We start today with a shakeup in Boston Pride leadership. Board President Linda DeMarco says she will resign this summer. And that comes after a year of pressure from local activists seeking leadership inclusion for Black and trans members of the LGBTQ community. June is Pride Month. WBUR's Arielle Gray has been following this story and joins us now to tell us more. Welcome, Arielle.
Hi, Tiziana. Thank you so much for having me today.
Great to have you. So DeMarco's resignation didn't happen overnight. Maybe start by reminding us how we got here.
Well, I think we can kind of bring things back to 2020 last year, when kind of these groups that splintered off from Boston Pride initially called for accountability and an accountability process with Boston Pride's board. And 80% of Boston Pride's volunteer workforce actually resigned until the board committed to a process, an internal process of looking at their own internal racism and some other issues that were going on internally. But I think we can even bring it back farther than that to 2015, when Black Lives Matter actually stopped the Boston Pride March and demanded. They had a whole list of demands for the Boston Pride board, and one of the major ones was diversifying their board and changing their inherent structure. So it kind of starts it started last year, but it actually.
Oops, I think we might have lost Arielle's sound there. And so while we get Arielle back, I'll just fill in the picture there that then the changes, as I understand it, had not happened quickly enough for activists who were continuing to put pressure on Boston Pride for DeMarco to step down and to open the board to a more inclusive group as Boston Pride goes forward. We're now looking at the 50th anniversary celebration of Boston Pride having been postponed twice due to the pandemic, once last year, then it was scheduled for Pride Month this year, and then postponed again, once again due to the pandemic. But the resignation of Linda DeMarco does seem to create some question as to whether the Boston Pride 50th anniversary can now go forward as there's changes in leadership. Arielle, do we have you back?
Hi, Tiziana. So sorry for that interruption.
It happens. So listen, local activist groups such as Trans Resistance Massachusetts have organized their own events. This is Pride Month. They have events going on this month, including the second annual vigil in March this Saturday. But tell us how else they have shown some real increasing political strength and what that means for Boston Pride as an organization.
I think we can see a little bit of this, I guess, quote unquote, increase in political strength with the debate that happened on Monday. Basically, you know, these, I guess, splinter organizations were able to have on all of the mayoral candidates to talk about issues like protecting queer and trans people of color here in Boston. But I would be wary to say that this is an example of their increase in political strength. I think that a lot of local organizers here who are involved in the boycott are still kind of skeptical of whether or not politicians are actually going to push legislation or changes that will protect the queer and trans community here in Boston. I mean, just 5 years ago, Massachusetts passed this very long-awaited transgender public accommodations bill, which protects transgender people from discrimination in restaurants, libraries, hotels, et cetera. But 2016, you know, trans activists have been fighting for this for decades. So it's kind of still kind of tricky to say whether or not local groups have any political strength or power.
So kind of there's a difference between increased voice and that turning into a political cash that leads to change.
Exactly.
So in our remaining time, I want to ask you, people of color in the trans community have fought exclusion from the beginning of the LGBTQ rights movement. I'm thinking back to Stonewall. I wonder, can you put what's happening today in Boston in this moment into a larger historical context for us in the next minute or so?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is kind of just a continuation of what queer and trans people of color have been fighting for since Stonewall in 1969. I mean, we can see there was a movie that came out about Stonewall in 2015, and the main character was a white man. So there is still a lot of erasure going on in the LGBTQ plus community that's not quite, it hasn't been addressed in the way that it needs to be. And also racism hasn't been addressed in the way that it needs to be in the LGBTQ plus community. So what's happening today in Boston is really kind of indicative of what's happening nationally with Pride. I think there's a lot of criticism about Pride being commercialized, about these big corporations being able to kind of tag themselves onto Pride without actually putting in the work or the resources into addressing some of these inherent systemic issues that impact queer and trans people of color the most, specifically Black trans women. So there's still a long way to go. I think that this is definitely a step in the right direction, but it's a story that's been a long time in the making, and I think we can only wait and see how things will turn out here in Boston.
WBUR's Arielle Gray. Arielle, thanks.
Thank you.
We're going to turn now to cities and towns and their streets. The pandemic forced cities and towns to get creative. People wanted to gather safely, and they needed more space to do that safely outside. So communities closed down whole streets for bikers and walkers. You know, restaurants turned curbside parking spaces into tiny garden patios. We all saw it. Well, now a new poll from the Mass Inc. Polling Group finds that many of those workarounds worked, and people want them to stay. WBUR's Zeninjor Enwemeka has been combing through the data and joins us now. Zeninjor, thanks for coming back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana. Glad to be here.
So give us the main takeaways of the poll, because it does sound like people want streets shut to traffic even after the pandemic ends, if you can say that word.
Right. It might be. Exactly. Are we at the point of saying the end of the pandemic? But, you know, this poll shows that people do want to really change the way that we use our streets to continue a lot of the things that we've seen in the pandemic. So nearly 80% want more space for outdoor dining. And nearly 60% want to close streets to car traffic so pedestrians and cyclists can use the entire roadway. People also want more public seating, like benches. Now, you know, this is something many cities and towns made these changes during the pandemic to help local businesses and encourage more outdoor activities. Here's what Mass Inc.'s research director, Rich Parr, says about that.
And it seems as if people are pretty happy with some of the changes that cities and towns have made to local streets during the pandemic, so much so that they want to continue them and want to see them going forward. Even when we told voters that this would mean that there would be less space for cars on the streets.
And Boston area voters want to keep these changes in place after the pandemic. Again, even if that means less space for cars.
So this was a poll of 670 registered voters in Greater Boston. You have covered transportation for a long time. Do these results surprise you?
You know, it's really interesting. In a way, it shows that the pandemic has sort of created a new normal for people. You know, something I've been thinking about, Tiziana, is how the pandemic forced us to think about space in a different way. You know, we had to physically distance, keep 6 feet apart. We were encouraged to go out and use outdoor spaces. So how we think about space has shifted. First, it was a public health necessity because of COVID-19. And now, this poll shows, people really liked some of the ways we adapted to those space constraints. And they want to see some of those things stick around post-pandemic.
So for cities and towns that want to be responsive, how do you see this playing out?
Well, so far, cities and towns seem to be sticking with some of these pandemic changes. It expanded outdoor dining, closing down certain streets for pedestrians. I see that all over the place where I live in Cambridge. This was something that was really beneficial to businesses during the pandemic when they had so many restrictions on indoor dining. And in Boston, the city is allowing more outdoor dining this summer through a pilot program. In Waltham is shutting down its Moody Street downtown for a second year in a row, so the whole street can be used for dining and pedestrians. And Ipswich has received funds from MassDOT to repurpose a parking lot and turn that into a year-round riverfront outdoor dining and gathering space. And of course, it's certainly the perfect time of year to transform city roadways. I mean, we're heading into summer. That's a high travel and tourism season, as well as fall, when many people just want to be outside and enjoying the outdoors.
So as an injured, that poll asked a lot of questions. Are there other ways that people would like to see streets transformed?
Yeah, the MassInc poll found 3/4 of Boston area voters want bike lanes, and roughly around 70% want more parking for bikes, as well as more stations for bike share. And I should note, too, people were also thinking about buses. Nearly 2/3 said they support implementing more bus lanes. This is something we've been seeing more cities and towns implementing in recent years in an effort to make bus rides more, you know, quicker and more efficient.
So here's the million-dollar question. All of that uses street space. So do people say that they will drive less?
Well, now this was a really interesting part of the poll. 27% of people said they actually plan to drive more post-pandemic, which was higher than the percentage of people who said they will drive less. Now, some of that may be because some folks don't plan to use public transit as much, but it's interesting to think about, what does this mean for traffic if people want to take away car space for other purposes, yet some people want to drive more? It seems people in this poll were very concerned about traffic congestion. 42% think it will be the same as it was before the pandemic, which we all know was bad. And nearly 1/3 think it will actually be worse. Only 21% think it will be better. So we have a little bit of optimism there for some folks, but we'll have to wait and see. And really, some of this may depend on what companies in the region decide to do about their future work plans. You know, it's also a challenge for cities and traffic planners if they're going to be taking space away from cars for things like outdoor dining and walkable streets and bike lanes. They're going to need to figure out how and where all of those people in cars are going to travel.
WBUR reporters and Injur Enwemeka, thanks for walking us through it. Appreciate it.
Sure thing.
So let's look specifically at how one community is thinking about this. Brad Rawson is on the line. He's the director of mobility for the city of Somerville. Brad, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon, Tiziana. Thanks so much for having me.
So we're glad to have you. And I know you heard Zeninja walk us through those poll results from the MassInc Polling Group poll. Anything surprise you there?
Tiziana, the poll results are really consistent with what our constituents in the city of Somerville tell us year after year, that restoring the more historical function of urban streets to serve people walking, people wheeling, people riding bikes, people riding buses, people doing business and dining is really where our community wants to use our precious street resources. Tiziana, Somerville is just 4 square miles. One of those square miles is streets. They have to do more for our residents than simply move motor vehicle traffic.
And you tried that. You shut down several miles, not square miles, but linear miles of streets for pedestrian access. How did that go? And are you still doing it?
Well, Tiziana, I think it's really important to frame Somerville's Shared Streets program through the lens of our holistic COVID-19 strategy. Early during the emergency, Mayor Joe Curtatone asked our staff to devise a holistic and equitable strategy to keep people safe, to support our first responders, our small businesses, and make sure that our residents, particularly the 25% of us who do not own or operate a motor vehicle, can still access essential goods and services, grocery stores, post offices, pharmacies, food pantries. And really rethinking the way that we manage our streets was a core part of that strategy. So dedicating space using low cost and cheap, quick and nimble materials like sawhorses, signs, and cones to divert regional traffic from local streets was an important way to provide people with predictable and safe ways to get to all of those essential destinations in our little city.
Right. Was outdoor dining also a part of that?
Yes, absolutely. That was an essential part of our strategy. And it's really rooted in national and international best practice. In Somerville, we worked with our small business community and our local stakeholders to really offer up the choice for folks to say, look, if we think that we can more safely and effectively continue to do business by repurposing a curbside parking space, for example, to allow for outdoor dining. We wanted to invite the business community to work with our staff to identify those locations, appropriately plan, inspect, and regulate them, and then let business owners do business consistent with public health guidance.
So let me jump in there. I can hear how serious you are about this and that you're passionate about it. What did you hope would happen, and did that happen?
Well, Tiziana, I think our program in Somerville has been successful, and I really want to emphasize that mobility equity is tied to social equity. Mobility justice is tied to economic justice. And it's important that we all remember that as we work so hard to strive for normal, let's remember to define normal circa 2018 and 2019 as unsustainable and inequitable. Our residents in Somerville expect us to decarbonize our transportation system. Our residents in Somerville expect us to address systemic racism and historic inequities through all of our decisions.
I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but I'm going to, because what I want to ask you is, I hear what you're committed to, but as you ran this experience during the pandemic, did you get the results that you wanted out of those things? Did you see a reduction in carbon footprint? Did you see more freedom of movement? What do you think worked?
You know, it really depends, Tiziana. We collected so much data on traffic counts, on traffic speeds, traffic crashes, MBTA bus ridership, MBTA bus travel times, business starts, business closures, customer visits. And in most of our neighborhoods, we found exactly the results that we wanted, which was that our streets were safer, that they were more sustainable, and that they were more economically productive. There were exceptions to that rule. Everything is context and case specific. But we actually had many, many Somerville resident volunteers working as our eyes and ears, helping us collect data in addition to our professional staff and consultant teams that were out on the block working with the local community to evaluate the results.
So what comes next?
Well, again, we have established long-term strategic plans based in community process here that call on us to continue to strengthen mass transit in our community. I want to emphasize that MBTA buses and trains are safe. Extensive research has been done about air circulation on mass transit. Anybody who has the choice to commute on mass transit should use it. Because traffic is coming back. Greater Boston has been designated as one of America's worst congested metros. And the poll results you just described should concern all of us as we think about the future of the MBTA, sustainability of long-term funding, and making sure that all of our residents all over the metro area can continue to move around in ways that are predictable, safe, and sustainable.
All right. Brad Rawson, Director of Mobility for the City of Somerville, thanks for joining us. In the before times, parents fretted about screen time, how to keep kids off the internet, off the TV. Then came the pandemic. Between remote schooling, virtual social lives, parents trying to balance work and home, often from home, we have spent the last year essentially putting kids on screens, on the internet. So now what? Well, we invite you to pull up a chair, come to the virtual kitchen table. We're going to talk about that. We want to know, have your children's internet habits shifted? Has their behavior changed as a result of those habits shifting? And are you worried about their mental and physical health after being on screens for so many hours a day? We can also take some questions about how to wean them off and what to do next. Join the conversation, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. We are welcoming two guests back for this conversation. First, Dr. Andrea Spencer, a child, adolescent, and adult psychiatrist at Boston Medical Center, also an assistant professor of psychiatry at Boston University School of Medicine, and Kiana Agbai, a Boston parent, entrepreneur, and author of the blog and Instagram account Harlem Lovebirds. Dr. Spencer, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Kiana Agbai, welcome back to you too.
Thank you.
So I understand you're both parents. Dr. Spencer, tell me about your kids. How old are they? How do they use the internet and screen during this crazy pandemic time?
Sure. So I have two kids. I have a six-year-old and a four-year-old. The six-year-old is in kindergarten and so has been during the pandemic. And we definitely saw an increase in screen time, definitely in our family during the pandemic. And of course, in my clinical practice, I saw lots of kids having increased screen time of various forms. And you know, kind of the benefits and the struggles associated with that.
So Kiana, we've talked about your kids a number of times on the show, but remind us of them and tell us how it's been for screen time and internet time for them during this pandemic.
Yes, I have a 6-year-old and a 10-year-old. So similar to Dr. Spencer with the first grader. But for us, it was a really change of course, because in my household, before COVID, we limited screen time greatly. So Sunday night to Thursday night, there were no screens, no TV, no iPad. Granted, now my daughter about to enter middle school. Anyway, we know there'd be a little bit more screen time, you know, typing and starting to write papers and things of that nature. But we definitely reversed that policy during the past year. So Sunday night to Thursday night, the children were allowed to have screen time. So they've seen a complete change of course in, you know, our household policy.
Have the two of you worried about that as moms?
I have.
Go ahead.
I have for sure. I mean, especially for, you know, such young kids, and I'm constantly thinking about establishing habits that I want to last a lifetime. You know, these are the kinds of things that, you know, parents think about is, what are the longer term implications of what we do with our kids? And I think one of the things that has been interesting for me, both with my own kids and for my patients, is this change from, you know, really intentionally limiting screen time to this, almost about face of intentionally encouraging screen time in certain settings. And how confusing that can be for little kids, and for parents to navigate.
I want to put the number out for listeners too, 1-800-423-8255. As parents, do you feel that the situation has caused you to push your kids to the screen, push them to the internet? And if so, how has that gone? And do you have worries? Let's talk about that. I mean, everyone is navigating this, has been, and is trying to figure out what comes next. Kiana, for you as a mom, on balance, has this set well with you, or have you had worries?
I've had quite a few worries. I think too, because my son was partway through kindergarten when this happened. So back in March 2020. So thinking about just from a brain development perspective and the need for play and interaction and social emotional learning. So it really did feel like it went against everything I knew developmentally, you know, that he needed as a small child.
Dr. Spencer, is that a reasonable concern? Let's put your psychiatrist hat on now, and let's just talk about the brain development piece of what Kiana just said. Talk a little bit about that.
I agree with her. I think it is a concern. You know, as much as we try to make virtual interactions, you know, mean as much as possible, it's not the same as interacting with people face to face. And as she said, the very physical nature of learning when you're that young in particular is very hard to replicate virtually. And one thing that I've consistently noticed was a problem, among the other things, is the feedback that little kids get over, you know, for example, a Zoom class is very different. And feedback is so important. You know, when I say something, when I do something, both the positive reinforcement and the caring that comes from the adults in the room and the connection to peers in the room, and even the opposite, the sometimes negative reinforcement that's needed about, well, this is not something that we do. Let's think of an alternative, let's do this. Those kinds of interactions are very, very hard over video conferencing platforms, and we're missing. And for the youngest kids, that's a major concern that I have. So I think her concerns are very warranted.
1-800-423-8255. 1-800-422-5555. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Have you developed strategies that you want to share with other parents for managing screen time, for managing internet access during this internet heavy cycle we've had over the last year? Kiana, has it been all bad? I mean, I suppose as I'm thinking about the questions I've been asking, I keep saying, are you worried? Which suggests I think you should be. But are there benefits that you've seen for your kids in becoming internet savvy, in learning online, in being able to access content they couldn't otherwise?
Yes. I mean, my six-year-old has almost become like his own little tech support. So it's been really interesting to watch him. He's been fully remote, you know, even though I think Boston Public Schools went back fully in April, just for consistency's sake, as much as I knew he wanted that in-person interaction, just to keep things as stable as possible, we maintained him at home. So the remote piece for him, you know, being able to still be a part of the classroom has been important, but it's also, I've noticed, given him a sense of independence for being in control of, you know, his own device given to him by the school, learning how to work Zoom. He's really become adept at it, and it's enabled him even to sometimes hop in and make suggestions and troubleshoot with other students. So he's fully taken that on his own. I was really surprised to see that. And I think for his sister, as a fifth grader, the two of them knowing that they've been going through this remote experience together, she ended up going back in person, just being older and her situation being a smaller class size, letting her go back in person. But the two of them kind of seeing this through together, it's been really interesting to kind of watch them navigate it as a 6 and 10-year-old working their way through this very strange time.
Dr. Spencer, does it have to be a bad thing? I mean, is there a way to make lemonade out of these lemons?
I mean, I think, you know, as we saw at the beginning of the pandemic, there was a huge push to get kids connected, obviously, because that's how we needed kids to learn, and we needed to make sure kids were connected to the internet. And that shows you some of the benefit that the internet can have, connecting people, helping people access things they wouldn't have accessed before. And I've actually had some patients who have said, you know, my kid wasn't learning to read until I got this program on the tablet, and now they are super into it and know all their letter sounds. So I think there is a place for technology educationally, but I think that the real issues are, you know, when we think about screen time and whether it's okay or not, or whether it's actually beneficial, we have to think about how the screens are being used and also how much. You know, it's not about small increases necessarily. It's about excess use, and it's not about, whether you log into Facebook or not, or whether you log into any social media platform or not. It's about what you do when you're on there.
If a kid's zooming into school, though, isn't it by definition going to be excess use, at least for now, Dr. Spencer?
Well, I suppose that depends on your definition of excess use, but I think for most of the kids that I've seen go through this, I would say it would have met what most of us would have called excess use before the pandemic, that then all of a sudden became necessary use. But also, if you think about Zoom, you know, in some ways, Zoom might be better than other things that kids are accessing on the internet, that in which they have a level of independence that in some ways is good, but in some ways is concerning. In terms of using the internet.
Yeah, I mean, clearly all content is not created equal. And we know that there are, you know, apps and dimensions of the internet that are designed to draw you in and send you deeper down the rabbit hole. And that can be addictive. Kiana, have you had to manage that with your kids? And how do you manage what they're accessing on a screen when it's so hard to keep them away from a screen because schools are providing them with screens and they're being asked to be on screens and parents are busy and can't be watching what's on that screen all the time?
Yeah, that's been a struggle for me. I think early on with my 6-year-old, I didn't realize the device that he was given, the school issued device, did not have any type of screener software on it. We found that out the hard way. Somehow, he ended up on a website that was inappropriate. And so I quickly alerted the school and let them know about that. But I was, you know, just shocked that there wasn't any type of child appropriate safe software given to on these school issued devices. So that was a wake up call for me. But I think apart from school issued devices, just trying to get a sense of what the children are watching, you know, even with like Google Family, we became adept at being able to use that and monitor what the kids are doing on the back end. And even our internet service provider, they have ways that you can literally cut the internet off if needed by a specific device. So we're able to not only set time management tools for the kids, but also, you know, to the point that Dr. Spencer made about what are they doing on the screens, you know, if we're as a family, you know, playing a video game together, are doing one of the, you know, the dance party games and getting physical exercise that was really important in the winter. That was a great way for us to be together with a screen as a family doing a physical activity. So we were always cognizant and even still, you know, we are about how are we using the screens? What is the intention? Are we learning? Are we playing a game? Are we bonding? Even connecting over Zoom with family across the country, we were able to come together more often than not, you know, that made us think about why weren't we doing this before? Every other Sunday, we get together with family across several states now. And I think that's something that's going to stick with us. We're going to keep that going on Zoom. So just like what Dr. Spencer said, there are some things that are good, you know, that are going to come with us, but now we're going to be in the process, especially as school lets out, how are we going to walk back some of that screen usage? And that's kind of what I'm struggling with right now.
So let's turn to you, Dr. Spencer. We have a couple minutes left, so two questions. How to recognize if your child has been exposed to content that could be harmful, and tips for now beginning to scale back internet and screen usage in this beautiful weather as school ends and as the world begins to reopen, or at least our area begins to reopen.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I would say that unfortunately, sometimes it's hard to know what kids are looking at on the internet, and it's hard for parents, especially parents who are working from home, you know, to supervise them as much as we would like. But I would say, I think Kiana's points are very, very important. When you can be there with your child to help them navigate it and help them understand what's appropriate and inappropriate, but when you can't, try as much as possible to talk with them about it and ask what they're looking at and even ask to see what they're liking on the internet or what their favorite site is, you know, so you can actually see what they're doing and what they're enjoying, because that will be illuminating. So you can figure out what are they watching and is it something that's educational or is it something that's inappropriate, which Kiana is not the only parent to have dealt with that issue on school issued laptops during the pandemic. I can tell you from seeing so many families, what an issue and that then, was. And then for the summer, then, yeah. I would say get outside. You know, I think getting outside is my kind of number one goal for my family and families across our area. You know, get outside, and that will keep your kids off screens and keep them interacting in a healthy way.
That is Dr. Andrea Spencer, child, adolescent, and adult psychiatrist at Boston Medical Center. She's also an assistant professor of psychiatry at the Boston University School of Medicine. And Kiana Agbai, Boston parent, entrepreneur, and author of the blog and Instagram account Harlem Lovebirds. Thanks to both of you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Again tonight, we bring you one of our favorite book conversations. We know summer means a little extra time to get lost in a good read. Last night, we heard from Mendon author Michael Togas about his memoir, The Waters Between Us, which tells the story of his life and the real heroes in it, such as his father.
My dad was one of those larger-than-life figures. As soon as somebody saw him, they'd be smiling, and he would just light up a room. He never came to my wrestling matches, my soccer games, but a little later when I was struggling and dropped out of college, he had my back and he really surprised me. I did not expect that.
Tonight, we bring you a timely conversation from Dorchester native Patrick Radden Keefe. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of Empire of Pain, The Secret History of the Sackler Dynasty, which focuses on the family of founders and owners of multi-billion dollar Purdue Pharma, the company behind the powerful prescription opioid OxyContin. So many people in the Commonwealth have been affected by the opioid crisis. From 2000 to 2019, approximately 19,800 people died of an opioid-related overdose in Massachusetts. That data from the state's Department of Public Health. Yet accountability for the opioid crisis and the lives lost remains elusive. Many state attorneys general, including Massachusetts AG Maura Healey, have taken aim at Purdue Pharma, filing lawsuits to hold the company and its owners, the Sackler family, accountable for their role in this epidemic. Now, we've covered the Sacklers extensively on WBUR and Radio Boston, both the charges against them and their responses. You can find that coverage on our website at radioboston.org. Right now, Democrats in Congress are pushing a bill that would prevent the Sackler family from using a corporate bankruptcy as a shield for personal liability. In his book, Keefe talks about the evolution of the Sacklers' signature drug, OxyContin, and how the family strategized to track and target doctors who were prescribing a lot of this drug and pushed them to prescribe more.
There was just huge ambition for this drug. There was greed, but I also think there was idealism. There was a sense that throughout human history, it had been impossible to disentangle the risky aspects of opioids, you know, from the therapeutic benefits. And they felt like we've cracked it. We've hacked it. We figured out a way to get opioids to people who are suffering from pain in such a way that they won't have to worry about addiction. Now, all of this turns out to have been conjecture and wrong. But what they did was they had this army of salespeople who went out and they met with thousands and thousands of doctors across the country. I've interviewed these former sales reps. They were very heavily incentivized to get doctors prescribing as much as they could. They all said they had this line that they repeated like a mantra where they would say, it's not addictive. It's addictive less than 1% of the time. Less than 1% of the time. That's what they said again and again. The tagline, the kind of marketing phrase for OxyContin was, it's the one to start with and the one to stay with. So the idea was this is not some nuclear solution that you graduate to when other courses of therapy have failed. This is what the first thing you do. If somebody comes to you in pain, is you prescribe them OxyContin.
So clarifying, the 1% was not an accurate claim.
It wasn't. It was a totally bogus claim. I think the company and the family was soon confronted with evidence of that because it really didn't take long for the problems with the drug to make themselves known. But to me, that's where it becomes a really interesting story, is how they get kind of stuck in when it turns out that their initial hypothesis about the drug and what it can do turns out to be wrong. It's the sort of collective denial and delusion that they have in insisting that there's not a problem when there clearly is one.
So the Sackler family is where this story comes home to Massachusetts in a number of ways. Tufts became the first major university to remove the Sackler name from buildings and programs in 2019. That seems to have set off a chain reaction, a sort of next level abnegation of the Sacklers. Why do you think Tufts was the first to actually do it? And talk about the impact that had on a family who wanted its name public in philanthropy and hidden in business.
A couple of things happened. You know, there's this paradox that kind of runs through this story. And it's not just recent. I mean, this happened, I was able to trace it right back to the 1950s, where the family was very determined to put their name, the Sackler name, on all of their charitable gifts and gifts to museums, gifts to universities. You have Sackler Halls and Sackler Wings and Sackler Lecture Series, but never on the family business. And this was true in the 1960s when Arthur Sackler makes the first great fortune by marketing Valium, another addictive drug, but also true in the 1990s. And even when I started writing about Purdue Pharma initially in 2017, you could go to the website of Purdue Pharma, this company that the family owns that has generated all these billions, and search for the Sackler name, and you wouldn't find it anywhere. There was no acknowledgement on the company's website that it was owned by the Sackler family. So it's this weird thing where they put their names on all the philanthropy, but then keep their name off of the family business. And the real turning point, you know, I wrote a piece about the Sacklers in 2017 in The New Yorker. And at the time, I didn't think it would be possible to write a book because they were so secretive. And the big turning point for me happened in early 2019 when Maura Healey did something that nobody else had done up to that point, where pretty much every state in the union was suing Purdue Pharma over its role in the opioid crisis. But the state of Massachusetts sued individual members of the Sackler family for their role in helping direct what was happening at the company and named a bunch of the family members who had sat on the board of the company. And that, I think, was a big turning point because it laid out in black and white in this big legal complaint all the evidence that this was not some remote family that was checked out and just collecting the checks. They were calling the shots. In terms of Tufts, it was the students. It was the students. It was medical students at Tufts who said, I don't want to go and learn to be a doctor in a building that is named after this family. And the Tufts administration was, you know, they really listened to the students and eventually decided to take this quite radical step, which was to literally chisel the name off the walls.
So Attorney General Maura Healey here in Massachusetts names 8 Sacklers. You lay out that by the time she takes that step, they have extracted significant, if not most, money out of the company into personal accounts, sheltered accounts, et cetera. And you argue in anticipation of something like what A.G. Healey did.
Yeah, I mean, it's this crazy aspect of the story. And I should say it wasn't just significant, it was most. So in 2007, Purdue Pharma pled guilty to federal criminal charges of misbranding OxyContin. And they ended up actually pleading guilty again to a new set of federal criminal charges just this last year in 2020. And in the interim, you have all these states like Massachusetts bringing their own lawsuits against the company. What the public didn't know until fairly recently is that in the run-up to this period, the Sacklers are quietly pulling money out of the company, $300 million here, $400 million there. They end up taking more than $10 billion out of the company. And then when you have this huge kind of tsunami of lawsuits, they say, oh, too bad. Company doesn't have any money left. Purdue's going to declare bankruptcy. And basically said, we can't fight these lawsuits. We can't settle these lawsuits. We just don't have enough money. There's not enough money left. And the Sacklers are sitting on the sidelines, having pulled more than $10 billion out of the company. And they seem, at least for the moment, to be protected.
Ultimately, Attorney General Healey and other attorneys general like New York's Letitia James rejected a $10 billion settlement that was offered by Purdue and favored by some Republican attorneys general. It didn't reflect Sackler money, really. It didn't inflict financial harm on the Sacklers. The argument was that it wasn't enough, didn't really represent accountability. Later, the company reached a lighter settlement with the Department of Justice. Maura Healey has called that chump change. It doesn't name names or bring criminal charges against anybody. You paint that decision as a reader, it felt to me, in an attractive light, the decision not to compromise or take that settlement. In retrospect, is there an argument to be made that Maura Healey should have engaged more with the initial settlement offer to get some money that appeared to be on the table for things like addiction programs, local governments fighting the crisis on the ground, et cetera?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways of looking at it. I mean, I should say, and it all gets extremely complicated, but to break it down a little bit, initially the proposal by Purdue and the Sacklers, they alleged that this was a $10 to $12 billion proposal that they were making. I think when you actually look at the math, you know, and when you start breaking down those big multi-billion dollar numbers, a lot of that was pretty conjectural and sort of based on future profits from sales of things. I mean, it was, you know, in terms of the actual cash on the barrel, it was a much smaller number that they were offering. Specifically, the Sacklers were offering $3 billion of their own money. And Maura Healey at the time, and some of the other, as you say, the more kind of forward-leaning state attorneys general said, that's not enough. You know, they would be walking away with the huge bulk of a fortune, which they pulled out of this company during a period of time at which we now know it was committing federal crimes. As to whether or not that was a savvy decision by Maura Healey to reject the initial offer, the Sacklers have subsequently upped their offer to $4.25 billion of their own money. So it, just in terms of the kind of pure negotiation, I think it was probably pretty smart not to take the initial offer.
You know, I as I sort of reached the final pages, about 450 pages into the book, and there's this journey we've been on, I know the public reporting, right, obviously, but I think I thought there was going to be a level of comeuppance that it feels like, it sounds like, it reads like just didn't happen. Is that right?
I think it is right. Look, on some level, this is a book about impunity. It's about the way the super elite in this country, the billionaire class, tend to be insulated at every level of the system from any real accountability for their actions, no matter how hazardous and disastrous those actions might be. I think the way this is going to end is that the Sacklers will end up giving up several billion dollars of their own money. They will walk away with vastly more. I don't know that there's going to be, I don't think they'll face criminal charges. I don't know that there's going to be comeuppance of the sort that if you were a retail heroin dealer selling heroin on the street, you might be faced with. I think they'll be insulated from that. You know, there's an anecdote that I relate in the book about Isaac Sackler, the original patriarch, the father of the original three Sackler brothers. And during the Great Depression, he loses everything and he gathers his sons. He tells them, listen, I have nothing to give you. I have no money. You're going to have to pay for your own educations. But I've given you the most important thing that a parent can give their children, which is a good name. This is at the height of the Depression. He says, you know, if you lose a fortune, you can always earn another one. But if you lose your good name, you can never get it back. And to me, that is this very powerful moment because it explains both the frenzy with which the Sacklers have put their names on things. But I think it also does articulate a kind of comeuppance. It's not justice. It's not real accountability. But I do think that this is a family that has been engaged in the kind of brand management of the family name for seven decades. And I do think that at this point, the public has woken up to what happened with OxyContin and to the family's role in this. And so I think they've lost the good name. And that is something that I think they will never get back.
That was Dorchester native and New Yorker staff writer Patrick Radden Keefe talking about his book, Empire of Pain, The Secret History of the Sackler Dynasty. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman, with help from Stephen Gelman and Hafsa Qureshi. Our engineer is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.